They call it a whooping crane because it has more than an 8-foot trachea and can be heard for up to 3 miles away. But this voice almost fell silent. In 1941, whooping cranes were just 15 birds away from extinction. Today, the numbers are back up to nearly 500, but these magnificent wading birds still hover on the edge of survival, and they recently took another serious blow. Earlier this month, a tornado ripped through the Gulf Coast of Florida. It killed 20 people and 17 whooping cranes in the Chazahowitzka National Wildlife Refuge near Tampa. The story of what happened to the birds and how a flock of whooping cranes got to Florida in the first place is rather remarkable, and perhaps best told by Joe Duff, the co-founder of Operation Migration. He joins us on the phone from Port Perry, Ontario. And Joe, perhaps you should start by telling us what you do for a living.
You wouldn't believe it if I told you.
Go ahead.
Actually, I run an organization that teaches whooping cranes, young whooping cranes, to follow ultralight aircraft. And then we use that technique to lead them on a migration from Wisconsin to Florida. And thereby we substitute for the parent and try to establish a new flock.
This is the University of Migration?
Yes, it is, actually, flight school.
So how far did you fly with the flock that was killed in this month's storm?
Every year, every fall, we start the migration. It goes through 7 states from Wisconsin to Florida, and it's about 1,235 miles.
Okay, how do you train a bird to migrate?
Well, a whooping crane, like a lot of species, learns a migration route by following their parent. These are precocial birds, so when they hatch, they imprint on the first thing that really pays attention to them, and that's normally, of course, the parent. So we substitute parent for pilot, and we imprint the birds on our handlers, and then, of course, we condition them to follow the aircraft. It's a process that starts in April and May when they hatch and is carried on right through the summer until the migration time, which is in early October.
So can you tell me about some of the birds that flew down to the wildlife refuge with you this past fall?
Well, I'll give you a little background first. This whole project takes place in what we call isolation rearing. In other words, every person who goes near the birds, and there are very few of them, wears a big baggy white costume, covers them head to toe. We also carry a digital recorder of an adult bird call and a puppet that looks like a whooping crane. The idea is not to look like a crane, it's to disguise the human form so that when these birds are released and they encounter their first normally dressed human, they'll be wild. So on their level, you actually become a bird.
How did you fit into the pecking order of this particular flock of birds?
Well, I'm not by myself. There's several handlers. Each one has a personality, and each one has a relationship with the birds. I'll give you an example. Last year, I wanted to get some photographs. I put my costume on, and I walked out. And as I approached, one of our birds from a previous generation, one of our older birds, came in and, of course, wanted to get near the chicks and wanted some of the food and wanted some of that activity. And they can be pretty aggressive, so I stood between them, and I challenged that adult bird, you see. And, of course, the first challenge is he raised his head, and I raised my head, and we had this little altitude battle until I win, of course, because I'm 6 feet tall. The next thing they do is they stamp their feet a little bit, so I stamp my feet, and they have this incredible challenge. It's called a stick toss challenge. It's kind of like in high school, you know, and the bird is kind of saying to himself, you know, you're so insignificant, you're so unimportant that I can actually turn my back and play with this stick on the ground and not even pay attention to you. And of course, the whole time, this eye is right on you, you know, and staring right at you. So there's the bird playing with one stick, and I'm back to back with him playing with another, you know, challenging him, and he's challenging me. And he finally got fed up, and he walked around to the side of the little pond, and I walked over and cut him off again. And we had a few more challenges, and then finally, after about an hour, he just left on his own. It was just an amazing interaction with a bird. It was just such an incredible thing to do.
Tell me about some of these birds that flew down to Florida with you this past fall.
Well, as I said, each one has an individual personality, but we don't name the birds. We number them. We're trying to convey the idea to the public that these are not pets. But you certainly become attached to them. There's one particular bird that I liked, is number 10. I could recognize that bird in the air because his primaries were slightly damaged. There's a little gap in one of his feathers, and I could see it in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I'd look out to my wingtip, that bird would be lead, you know, and he would be always doing something stupid. You know, he'd be in front of the wing or challenging me, and he'd cut behind the aircraft or over top of it or underneath it. And number 10 was always where he wasn't supposed to be. He was always leading the flock off somewhere. So, you know, I kind of got to like him. He was a bit of a maverick.
And then you get the news that this tornado has killed this entire flock, or what happened when the storm hit the wildlife refuge where the young birds were staying?
Well, and of course we don't know because it was way out there, but once the birds arrive in Florida, we have a release pen, which is about 4 acres, and it has 8-foot-high walls, and it's protected by an electric fence, but it's not top-netted. Then they fly in and out, and during the day they learn to forage on natural food, and at nighttime they come back because that's where they roost and that's where the food is, and they're inadvertently protected from predators. Well, we now have 4 or 5 generations of birds that have all wintered in that pen. So that's their destination when they come back once they're released. So if they arrive at that pen and there's a bunch of chicks handy, then that means there's free food for them as well, and they become aggressive. They can chase the chicks out of the pen. So the only management technique we have is to move the chicks into a top-netted pen. Once we do that, then the food, of course, is gone, and the target of their aggression is gone, and they just move on, and the chicks are allowed to go free. And we were just about to do this when this unforecast and unforeseen storm hit. Nobody knew it was going to be as intense as it was. We had handlers out there checking the birds at 4 in the afternoon, and everything was fine. The birds were happy, and there was just a light breeze, and it was overcast, and that storm turned deadly about 3 in the morning. And the birds were discovered the next day.
How big an impact will the loss of the hatchlings of 2006 have on the overall population of the whooping cranes here in North America?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, back in the 40s, there were only 15 birds, and this population was growing nicely. But that was our 6th year, and we had 81 birds out there, and we had an 80% survival rate, so it was we were doing really well. Whooping cranes breed when they're 3 to 5 years old, most successfully at 5 years of age. So 5 years from now, or actually 4 years from now, because they were yearlings, we're going to have a downturn in the number of nests we have and the number of breeding pairs coming online.
As I understand, there is a bit of a story of hope here that you had a survivor?
Yes, we don't know how, but one bird managed to escape that terrible storm. You know, that storm is considered, you know, a 50-year storm. There were also 20 people killed in that same episode, so it was a pretty devastating event. And we really don't know how, but the next day, number 15 couldn't be found. And each bird has a tracking device on it, so the next day we put an aircraft up with a tracking device, and it was found about 10 miles inland with a bunch of other sandhills. So that's one bird at least.
Joe Duff is co-founder of Operation Migration and trainer of cranes. Thank you so much.
Thank you.